Welcome to the City Club of Eugene, June 8th, 2008 program, the annual Turtle Award program. This is the 34th program of, in our 2018-2019 programming year, and I am Joel Corin, president of the City Club. You can become a member of City Club at cityclubofeugene.org. We are a volunteer organization, and we have support from our diamond sponsor, Kaiser Permanente. Kaiser Permanente exists to provide high-quality, affordable health care services and to improve the health care of our members and the communities which we serve. More information at www.kp.org. We also have our Sapphire sponsors, George Rohde Car Repair, providing car care with a conscience, and three repair locations in Eugene, Euro-Asian Automotive, Stadium Automotive, and Auto House. Online at EugeneRepairs.com. And our gold sponsors, Luvas Cobb Attorneys at Law, Network Charter School, the Oregon Country Fair, the Academic Extension of the University of Oregon, Dot Dotson's Photography, KVRM. And today, the Turtle Program is one of my favorite programs every year. It's a 27-year tradition honoring some of the best and brightest people in Eugene, people who have made substantial contributions to the fabric of Eugene. And I'd like to thank all the turtles who are here and all the turtles who are out there for participating, and I'd like to thank all the people who worked to make this program possible. John Van Landingham was the first turtle, and he is have been since then the holder of the honorable title, the Herder of the Turtles, or King of the Turtles. He has done his job nobly, and each year the turtles come through with great recommendations for new members. And I do hope that next year at the Turtle Award, we will move the Turtle Award back to the annual meeting, which I think is a perfect combination and a good way to end a year and start a year. And now John Van Landingham will explain more about the turtles and introduce the speakers.
Thanks, Joel. As Joel said, I am John Van Landingham, and I am a turtle. I serve as the unelected chair of an unofficial committee, the Turtle Committee. Since the first Turtle Award in 1991, in that 27-year period, there have been 48 of us that have been recognized by the City Club. 39 of us are still alive. The Turtle Committee, I think, is the best committee to ever be on. We meet only once, and we have only one job, and that is to recommend future turtles. We have very lively debates. You might not be surprised to know that turtles have strong opinions. They're sometimes that we're all happy with one another, and sometimes when we're not. As noted, the first Turtle Award was given in 1991. The idea came from three of the founders of the City Club, one of whom is here today, Gene Tate, Jerry Gatos, and Bob Moulton. Bob is no longer alive. But they came up with the idea and the criteria, which I'll describe in a minute. And the first turtle, me, was given an actual physical turtle, which was a cast iron turtle that Gene had found in an art gallery in Santa Fe and given to her husband, Wayne. She stole it from Wayne and gave it to the first turtle. I want to recognize the turtles who are here, and if I miss somebody, please tell me. Gene Tate is here. Hold your applause. No. I don't know whether people want to stand up. Susan is here and won't be able to stand up, but she can certainly raise her hand. So Susan Siegel, Gene Tate, Sue Pritchard and Hugh Pritchard, John Stafford, Steve Moe. I should note that Steve is the unofficial mayor of Glenwood, so the awards have not been limited to Eugene only. We also recognize Bill Marcet, the former mayor of Springfield. Did I say John Brown? Dan Bryant? Did I leave anybody out? Who's a turtle? Oh, I thought I said Anita Johnson, sorry. One of the most recent turtles. Oh, and George Russell, sorry. Call him out for being late. So the criteria for the Turtle Award are that this person fosters creative problem solving in Eugene's public affairs, or Springfield's, stimulates constructive action, forges cooperative relationships, honors diverse perspectives, and sticks his or her neck out for the good of the community. We have three turtles that we're recognizing today. The presenters are going to introduce and describe why that person deserves to be a turtle, and then that person is going to talk, we hope, a little bit about what motivates him or her to stick his or her neck out for the good of the community. And the first presenter is Robin Quirk.
Hi, thank you. So as he said, my name is Robin Quirk, and I've been lucky enough to work with Tom Bowerman at Policy Interactive Research since 2013, and I'm honored to introduce him today. So first, I'm going to convey to you a bit of who Tom Bowerman is. When I met Tom, he made his low-carbon, once-a-week trips to town in his well-used Geo Metro. He has since upgraded to a pre-owned Nissan Leaf, onto which he has bolted a PVC pipe to the front bumper so he can bump open farm gates. A one-of-a-kind Nissan Leaf, the farm edition. Tom packs a peanut butter and jelly sandwich on the rare days he comes to town, and he always offers half of it to whomever he's sitting with. He built the house where he and his wife raised their two boys, mills his own lumber on his home mill, has been brewing beer long before home brewing was trendy. If your sheep breaks its leg, he can fix it. Tom can run statistical software, write a legislative bill, and easily create a PowerPoint presentation, and often does several of these things in one day, and that is not a joke. Keeping this in mind, I'd like to guide your imaginations away from the plodding turtle and over to Tom as the quick and focused ski jumper, sticking his neck out, but with more focused determination. Tom skied for about three seasons on the University of Oregon ski team in the late 60s. I learned from Tom's wife, Chris, that he was the team's ski meister, which is the team skier who must participate in all four categories, slalom, downhill, cross country, and ski jumping. He was the U of O ski meister because he was the only member of the team who was willing to do all four categories, and every team needs a ski meister. Tom continues to fill that needed role. Although Tom has worked on many projects, a fitting analogy to his ski meister days is the Emerald Village Eugene Tiny House project. Designing, building, donating, and the ski jump of societal reform, Tom worked hard on building code legislation. And by the way, Tom claims that ski jumping is easy, which is something he has never claimed about trying to get a bill passed. Tom is also a climate change mitigation ski meister. When he learned about human-caused climate change, he looked for how he could reduce his own carbon footprint, which included the decision to stop using air travel and to purchase annual carbon offsets for himself and all of his immediate family members each and every year. Not able to give up hope, which would allow retirement, Tom regularly pores over academic papers on where to best place his efforts. He surveys Oregon voters in order to communicate to legislators what constituents want. Besides co-founding Mackenzie River Trust, Tom has donated generously to many environmental organizations, including the U of O's Environmental Law Program's ENR Center and our Children's Trust. Additionally, Tom has spent countless hours for several years working on getting a version of California's carbon cap and reallocation AB 32 passed in Oregon. He is one of the only people I know who walks his talk, and because of that, and because he always offers half of his peanut butter and jelly sandwich, I would be hard-pressed to think of anyone I know who I respect more than him. And with that, I'm honored to introduce Tom Bowerman. And the turtle, right?
I thought we weren't getting any more turtles. I thought only John got the turtle. Let me put it there. Thank you very much, all of you. It's a wonderful community to live in here. Sometimes we feel a little desperate with how controversy is handled, but it's wonderful to live in a place where these controversies are present, balanced, and we have lots of discussion about them. I will talk just a little bit about, when I came in with Dan Bryant standing there, I said, I haven't really figured out what I'm going to say. And he said, just talk about what makes your heart sing. And I just say, what really makes my heart sing is just being in the outdoors, out in the woods. I'm an earth firster without the attachment to the politicization that represents, or I'm a tree person. I'm a tree hugger. That's where I love to be, but some of the threats to the natural systems are coming from people, so I'm very interested in the human relationship with the natural systems. And we have a huge threat in front of us with respect to our human behaviors that's almost beyond comprehension, and that's where I started this current set of opinion research. But my opinion research really began when I was on the board of Thousand Friends of Oregon, and you may remember the term Measure 37, but what came first was Measure 7. These were two initiatives at the ballot, attacks on Oregon's land use planning system, which protects resource lands and agricultural lands and a lot of systems that aren't present in any other state. Hugh Pritchard and I once made a trip together up to Washington, and we came back down through the state and observed the difference between Washington and Oregon, and it was profoundly amazing how different it is where you have an Oregon system like that. But what happened was that we lost those two initiative votes by 20%, and we were representing ourselves to be Friends of Oregon, but we were getting voted down pretty badly, and I advocated on the board for some research and development and understanding where Oregonians were and their values. And the executive director at the time could not find the place and the time and the resources to do that. So I resigned and I put a couple of years into researching and paying for opinion research on that. And lo and behold, the legislative structure changed sufficiently at one moment, and I put some results that we had been working on values, Oregon values, in front of Floyd Przanski, and he says, I get it. And he contrived to appoint himself and another couple of people as co-chairs of a joint committee, and we brought forward a corrective legislation which turned the tables, and we recovered about 90% of what we'd lost on the Measure 7 and Measure 37. Measure 37 was the loss. Measure 7 was thrown out by the court on a technicality, but it showed me the power of doing values research with our public, because we don't get things without understanding where we are and finding that common ground and working on what we jointly value. And so when that experience was realized, I wanted to extend that into the climate change, which some very well-known researchers call a super wicked problem. Climate change is us, it's our behaviors, and we have norms and habits that we're very accustomed to being attached to, and we have powerful interests that convince us that we need to do these types of things. And yet right now, and over the past 7 years, we've been showing and revealing results that people say that we need to change our way of life. They agree, the public agrees at 80% that we need to change our way of life, such as living more simply, when put beside a question of we need to buy goods for the good of the economy, because it is consumption, and it is technology, and it is population, which is a famous formula, by the way, the IPAT formula, which is why we're dealing with climate change. And many other issues, I'm not going to go deep into that. The most latest concern is what's happening at the national level. where we are losing ground. While we may, I'm very optimistic about what we might be able to do in Oregon this coming session. The political winds are blowing favorably in the direction of adopting a cap and trade system for Oregon, and it's an important procedure to lend a hand to the other people that are already leading on that front. Oregon needs to be with them. But the current challenge is at the national level, where we have authoritarianism trending. It's a danger to the point that we've seen it happen in other countries in our immediate life generational experience, where fascism comes up. We should never drop our guard on that, and it represents a serious threat to everything that our country really represents. And Robin and I have been working on that, and I'm not prepared to really spend any time. It's complicated research. It's looking at dicing and slicing and repackaging and thinking about it. Other people are working on it. There are a lot of people that are really concerned about where our country is and where it may be going, but I'm going to close with that and say I appreciate living in this community again. It's a great place. We have a great environment, and thank you very much.
The next presenter and I are fathers of boys who have been best friends since they were born, pretty much daycare, and they're now 34. Todd Schneider.
Good afternoon. It's exciting for me to be able to talk about my good friends, Eric and Faye DeBurr, who are inspirational and very worthy of turtles, and I'll tell you a little bit about why. I first met them when I was on patrol with Eugene Police in the prevention unit, and I was very focused on what works in terms of prevention, so it really caught my eye when I started seeing what they were doing. It seemed new and fresh and especially effective, and that really makes a difference. So I would drop by there once in a while. I started out just dropping by to say thanks for what you're doing. I think it's really good for the community. And what I found out when I was there, that they were really nice people to be around. And I was coming from a work scene where there was a whole lot of cynicism, and you saw the dark side of people a lot, and it was so refreshing to be with people who found the good in people all the time, even in me. And I was finding myself coming back again and again. And the more I learned about them, the more impressed I became. These are people who really walk their talk, just like Tom Bowerman was described as doing. They build these amazing huts for people to live in, but they lived in one of these huts themselves for years until just very recently. And it was a great model of being what you're talking about, and not leaving it as an academic exercise. But they built really rapidly. It was really amazing how the group grew. It's only been around since 2013 when they first built a hut for people, and it snowballed from there into camps, and they opened a camp, and that was effective enough that they opened another camp, and now there are three camps. And this is all really incredible because it came after decades of the city of Eugene, with the best of intentions, fumbling the ball with how do we deal with homelessness effectively. So while we had some successes here and there, we had an awful lot of camps that failed miserably. And each time somebody tried to open another camp, there was more cynicism, more good reason to be wary and saying that maybe this can't be done. So it was into that environment that Eric and Faye inserted themselves, and lo and behold, they were pretty convincing, and especially the results of their programs were really convincing. So over just a period of 5 years, at this point, they have housed or sheltered about almost 500 people, and out of that 500 people, over 60% have been able to put their lives back together enough within 10 months to find more conventional housing, to find health care that they needed, to find ways to get on disability, to have something to work with. And even more impressive is that they're taking in the people often who just aren't going to fit in any of the other options in town because of their mental illnesses, because of their lack of ID, because they haven't been able to prove that they're veterans, or because they had dishonorable discharges. There's an endless list of obstacles that stop people from being able to get into other programs. When people talk about housing first on the national level, that's a nice concept, but there's an awful lot of people who aren't ready for that. They can't handle going into an apartment and paying rent each month yet. They need at least a few good nights sleep and just to feel safe to start working on putting their lives together before they can get there. So Eric and Faye took this on, and they have done just an amazing job of it. They really are great illustrations of everything on the list of what turtles are all about: sticking their necks out, creative problem solving, and on and on. And for all those reasons, I'm honored to call them up here now so I can present them with their turtles and turn the mic over to them.
We're glad to be up here and get to talk about what motivates us, because I guess it's probably not what people think. So early on, our family had need of shelter, and we didn't make a lot of money, so there wasn't a whole lot of options that were available to us. But we were, and still are, very resourceful and creative with how we do things. And I think it's meaningful for us to be receiving an award with in conjunction with Tom Bowerman. He talked about how we have to change our habits, and he's seeing this on a data level, and that's got to be really scary. For the last 10 years, it's sort of something that brought Faye and I together originally, is that we wanted to change our habits. We wanted to live differently. We wanted to live a simple life, a low-impact life, and a very deeply meaningful life. And when you don't have a lot of money, it can be challenging to do that, because you have to be sort of dependent upon so many other factors and institutions. And the way we did it is we had supportive community in our life, so we never really felt poor. And I'm giving Faye the look to just make sure that I'm not taking the mic from her, so just feel free to step in, okay? Okay. She always lets me know afterwards, you know, you talked a lot.
You're doing good, though. Good.
Okay. I guess she'll only stop me if she has to correct me. And so we started off, we actually started a business with no money in 2009, collecting materials from the waste stream and making useful products out of them. And we did okay with this, but we got labeled as recyclers, and that there was more to what we were doing. You know, we were building a community with what we had, and to kind of jump ahead, we eventually got into a building that was full of a lot of wasted material, and that's what attracted us to the building. And actually, John Brown sold us the building, or sold the people who bought it for us. Thanks, John. I still thank John for that. And we started there, and there is where we lived in a hut behind the shop that we designed the Conestoga hut in. We first designed the Conestoga hut for our own needs.
5 years. 6 years we lived in a hut.
Well, and
with
Faye.
Our son's here. We have to have two huts now because he's bigger.
Well, and Faye still lives in her fancy hut. So what's really propelled us in this work is figuring out how to apply the skills that we've learned through our own experience and our own struggles to the world around us so we can keep doing meaningful work. And we never really expected it to be, you know, serving the homeless.
We've just been really wanting to stay true to our values that Eric and I share. And we wanted to share what we had with other people. We feel like we've come to this work because we've been following our hearts and not overthinking things a lot.
Well, she can say that.
He thinks more than I do. I'm more of the heart-centered person, but he has too. We have a good balance. So yeah, we just were resourceful and we knew people and we knew how to connect with people and how to make things happen, and so then we are where we are now, and we're still doing that, but it's like on a much larger scale. We're like, I don't know, I'm kind of amazed that we're here. Like, it's only been 5 years and we've like come a long way. We've built 75 huts and we've helped almost 500 people, and the best part of the work is helping people. That is the best thing about being alive. It's like, it's the edge. It's the inspiration. It's where the grit is. It's where the glory is. And that's what keeps us going every day now, you know? We get to live our life. We get to structure our life. We've created this nonprofit. We have staff now that work with us and support us. And we get to help people. And we get to see people change. And I think what's really unique about our program is that most programs in town, you have to be clean and sober to, like, have a place to sleep at night. And when you're on the streets for a long time, it's really hard to be clean and sober because you have to fend for your life. And so when people find stability, they can find themselves again. And when they find themselves again, then they can begin the process of healing and becoming a member of our community again. And it's not easy work, it's dirty work, but it's the best work. And we had one fellow was in our program, he just came in last week, so he's really fresh for me. He was homeless, chronically homeless for over 25 years. He's one of those guys that hangs down at the river and was just kind of drinking and got a lot of trespassing fines and a lot of fines for drinking in public. Like, $8,000 in fines, you know, like, this is somebody that's, he pretty much gave up. And he had a friend in our program, and so he came and he tried us out. And he was in our program for about 3 months, and he started having some behavior problems because he kind of liked to drink too much. And so we went through the process where he got 3 write-ups. You know, we kept warning him, you're going to get a write-up. And at the third one, we give an eviction with the option for people to go to treatment to keep their spot. So he chose to keep his spot and go to treatment, and he was in treatment for 6.5 months. So he came in last week and he said, that was the hardest 6.5 months of my life. It was grueling and I had to like feel what I feel in my heart, and nobody likes to do that. But it was the best thing that you ever did for me. And I'm so grateful you wrote me up. I'm so grateful I went to treatment, because if I hadn't gone and I hadn't had the support of community-supported shelters, I wouldn't be housed now. He is housed, and he never thought that he would have the chance to be in a stable home. And he's so happy, and that's what keeps us going.
Not only is he housed, he keeps himself a lot more trimmed up. We would see him on the corner when he was in our program with his big long beard. And then during one of our check-ins with him, you know, I'm pretty slow to bring these kinds of things up, but I said, hey man, you know, he would smoke cigarettes and it would get stained yellow. I don't know if you've ever seen that. It's kind of gross looking. And I said, hey man, have you ever thought about just cleaning up your beard? And he looks at me, he's like, well, I think it works for me being on the corner. I think people, you know, maybe maybe think, feel sorry for me or something. I said, no, man, I think it's the opposite. And he's like, oh. And he took that in, and we actually paid for him to get his beard cut. And he stuck with it. Yeah, yeah. So, like Faye's saying, you know, what really keeps us going in this work is these stories of all the people's lives that we've got to share with. And that's the kind of social service that we've had the honor of creating, is one that really integrates people into a community, kind of like a starter community, where they get a certain kind of attention that they haven't gotten before, and where they can get stable again. So I bet our time is up here. We would love to just keep talking and sharing. Thank you for honoring us in this way. We're extremely grateful, and we just want to say thanks to all of our staff, our wonderful, wonderful staff, our dedicated volunteers, and our very generous donors who we could not do this work without. Our work is 90% funded by individual donors still. So,
and we love to share, and the folks that live in our communities, they love for people to come visit, and they can talk about their experience. And so if anybody's ever interested in visiting one of our communities, please look us up. Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you.
So I would say that those were two wonderful stories about what Dan Bryant described, what makes your heart sing, what motivates you. We have time for questions, and our recipients are not, I think, shy. So while you're thinking about questions you might ask, we're not set up for questions with microphones, but if somebody has a question, I'll repeat the question and they can answer. But while you're doing that, while you're thinking about questions, let me tell a story that I was reminded of by Tom Barman about our community. About 10 or 15 years ago, I got my arm twisted by George Russell as 4J superintendent, and Craig Smith as the school superintendent, the super school district board chair, to chair a citizen committee to identify 5 elementary schools to close. I can't think of a worse committee to be on than that. I actually ran into somebody at a locker room once, and he said, "You look familiar to me." And I said, "No, I don't think I know you." And he said, "Oh yeah, you're that angel of death that's trying to close my daughter's school." So at the end of that process, the committee did great work. We identified 5 elementary schools to close, and we ranked them. And there was to be one big hearing with the school board and the committee that I chaired. I was going to run the hearing. And it was at the Churchill High School cafeteria, which was packed with at least 1,000 people. The 5 schools that were targeted to be closed, their parents and teachers were all organizing. And then the schools that were next in line, because they were fearful if one of them got bumped off, they would move up. And I was standing on the stage before the testimony started next to George Russell. And I was thinking back to my many years of doing planning commission and LCDC work. And I was about to say to George Russell, "Oh my God, this is going to be horrible. Look at all those angry people." And before I could say that, George Russell turned to me and said, "Isn't it great that we live in a community where so many people care about their schools?" And wasn't he right?
You're listening to KLCC, informing and inspiring listeners for more than a half century. Broadcasting in HD at KLCC Eugene 89.7, KLCO Newport 90.5, KLFR Reedsport 89.1, and at 88.1, KLFO Florence, KMPQ Roseburg, and KLBR Bend. KLCC is a service of Lane Community College.
Yes? Go. Okay. So we're resuming with questions of the 3 newest turtles. And the first questioner.
My name is Robin Fletcher, and this question is actually coming from some new members
who were too shy to come up. But how the question is mostly for Faye and Eric, I guess, but you too, Tom. how do you deal with the ones that don't work when you emotionally, not how does one deal, but how do you deal with cases when one of your projects, one of your people falls backwards or one of your projects goes south?
Yeah, that's a great question. I thought it was when I don't work. So I guess we have a phrase for those people in our program. It's called the challenging ones.
Hard cases.
Oh, yeah, that's another one. Hard cases. And sometimes a hard case and something's not working, it's really an opportunity to engage that person. And there's, for example, sometimes evicting somebody is the best thing that we can do from our standpoint, because an eviction from us, it's an experience, and we don't just give them the eviction and shut the door on them. We talk about what went wrong, and so by setting that boundary and communicating with them and not losing the connection with them, it's an opportunity for them to experience a different kind of authority. You know, it's kind of like, it's tough love. We really try to explore what that means and to practice tough love. It's very effective.
I guess I just want to add that, you know, we really try to do a lot of self-care and spend time in nature. And and spend time with our family. We just try to do a lot to nurture ourselves, because it's difficult work, and it's difficult when we have to give someone an eviction or talk to them because they're keeping people up at night and give them a drug test. It's hard work and it's dirty work, and it's beautiful because of what Eric said, because sometimes when we just maintain the connection and have a loving, firm boundary, it's a new experience for people to make a change. So
I work most intensively on the homeless housing issue with Dan Bryant. And in the process of working on that, I come in contact with many people who are not familiar with the issues of homelessness. And this topic comes up, and it's a problem that needs to be addressed and conversed actively in the community. The way that I personally look at it, to answer the question as best I can, is that I read it as characterized in a Register Guard article some years ago. There are really three characterizations of people that have fallen between the cracks or that we're dealing with homelessness. Being able to pull themselves up by their bootstraps when they're given the chance. So we're trying to give them the chance, and when we give them the chance, there are those that can and will pull themselves up. There are those that can't, so they won't, because they can't, because they may have addiction issues or mental health issues that need help in other ways than Dan's efforts and the Square One Villages is provided to, and those that don't want to and won't. And my answer then is that we're giving opportunity for those that can step forward and take advantage of it, and those that can't, we try to redirect them as best we can, realizing that we can't address everybody, but there are many people out there, many, many people that need an opportunity to get back into the mainstream, and that's what we're trying to do.
Paul Thompson, a City Club member on and off since 2003. Obviously, you're all experts on the homeless question, and I know the DeBurrs have made what kind of look like a head start, a down payment, if you will, on solving the homeless problem. However, there is a role for government, both at the city and the county level. And we haven't really touched on this, but I'm sure that from your travels, you've formed an opinion of what government should be doing to make the next step, to really solve the problem. And I wish you'd comment on that.
I am a true believer in the role of policy. And that's really what the work that that I work with Robin on is, testing and developing policy. There's a significant lack of confidence and trust by members of our community in terms of the role that government provides in this arena of many different things, homelessness, especially people that are dispossessed, and that's especially true at the national level, and I addressed that just briefly on some of the things that I'm concerned about, where even the President of the United States is disrespectful of the need to address the dispossessed. But I think that's a challenge. I think government does need to recognize that. I think we need to have, I could tell you a couple of personal stories that I've had in my own experience with government, but not here. But I'm just gonna say that we need to be more efficient. We need to instill confidence, and we need to get back to kind of the level of confidence that we might have had back in the 50s, where trust in governance and confidence was at the 80% level, and it's fallen precipitously. So it has to be a multifaceted approach.
So I don't necessarily have an opinion about what government should do in these circumstances, but I can speak to what I think that the city of Eugene has done well. Since we've started doing this, we've also been contacted by many other cities, both employees and advocates from other jurisdictions. And what the city of Eugene did well in the case of helping our program get to where it is, it kept it all simple. It was willing to take a risk. You know, I think this Turtle Award is you know, should be as much dedicated to the city, because I didn't really understand at the time how much risk the city of Eugene was taking. I know that they had some tough situations to negotiate in the time when we started doing our work, and I think they did a good job. But they were willing to take a risk on a program that they have never tried before and provide a little piece of land for it to see if it worked, even though they had failed multiple times before. Learning about other cities now where it's hard to even make it legal to have people sleep in their cars at sites, that was I look back at our city, I'm like, oh, well, thank God that we have this city and not that city government. I've noticed the traits that really help these programs work is that willing to take a risk. We have a city in Walla Walla, or in Washington, Walla Walla, who they now have a 31 Conestoga hut, 31 Conestoga huts in a sleep center that they developed based upon our program and our structures. And it wasn't until they got a city member there that was willing to take a risk that it actually happened. So that's that.
Sandy Erickson, city club member. At the core of a lot of resistance to equality in housing and other areas of community life, there is what is termed NIMBY, not in my backyard. So since that's such a huge feature now, and it seems like once a neighborhood gets to a certain point, it automatically kicks in. I think it's human nature at its least attractive. But I wonder, in your experiences, what have you found that works best against that kind of grassroots force?
I really came face to face with that with our first safe spot on Roosevelt in the Train Song neighborhood, where I was asked to come to a neighborhood association meeting and talk to a bunch of angry neighbors who were not happy about, you know, a homeless camp coming to their neighborhood. And I was scared and nervous, and I didn't understand why they had brought their pitchforks and their torches. But I hung in there, and I just clearly, you know, they had all these ideas, And if I was to fight back, it would have just affirmed all their ideas. So I didn't fight back. I let them share to vent, and I listened. And then I talked about the vision of the program that we wanted to run there. We had never done it before. I just had this piece of paper that says how we would run it. So I was not very well equipped, but it gave them some assurance that we had thought this through and that we had an intention there. And that gave them a sense of security. And by the end of the meeting, after talking and hashing out this stuff, I remember one gentleman saying, "Well, I think we're willing to try this." But it took sitting at the table and not just badgering back and forth. I understood their complaints, and they had a lot to complain about and be upset about. And I had it in me to show a little empathy for those people with their concerns.
Good demonstration projects, successful projects such as we are working on here in Eugene are very effective. And as we have observed, people see these development housing projects, which are housing homeless people, and they see that they're clean, well-run, they're not risky, and other portions of the city that do not have them say, it's our turn now. So that is an effective method, and why we need to be really thoughtful and intentional in terms of how we do it.
Placement of affordable housing projects and homeless campgrounds, including in the 1990s at Autzen Stadium. I would add to that another important strategy is involvement. So involving the neighbors in the things that you're deciding and in evaluating it as you go forward. So, okay, fine. You're worried that we're going to do bad things. We'll meet with you on a regular basis, and you come tell us. And if you see a bad thing, we'll work on it together. Joel.
Joel Corin, City Club. This is a question for Tom. Last week, Robin from your office spoke to us about the research you'd done on different voting patterns, star voting and some of the other alternate voting patterns. I wonder if you have done research in Oregon on the issue of what it would take to get public support for increasing taxes to support education and infrastructure.
Yes, we have. And that's in the Oregon Values and Beliefs Project that I co-authored with Adam Davis of DHM Research out of Portland. And we had a set of questions which were around willingness to fund. And that particular process needs to be run deeper. We need to go into not quantitative research, but we need to have more qualitative research where we do focus groups and we dig down into that level of willingness to fund the educational model more effectively than we have been. So we have been, but I would say that on the education specifically or other aspects of public policy funding, it's always a challenge. People are frugal with their pocketbook, which is good on some level, but when we're squeezing the system to where we can't deliver the quality of services that we need, then we need to have that conversation more effectively. The way I look at it personally, that we live in a pretty wealthy society by world standards, and on many measures we're not keeping up with countries that have less than we do and how they distribute it effectively. But those are parts of the conversation.
Dan Bryant, City Club members. So knowing all three of you and knowing your lifestyle and what's important to you, I would just want to open up the question of connecting the dots between the work with the homeless and climate change energy usage. I've learned a lot from all of you on that topic and would just invite you to share where you see that connection.
It's one of the main reasons that I gravitated to when I saw opportunity unfolding, Opportunity Village, and seeing these little 80 to 120 square foot huts, sleeping huts, I've lived in buildings of that size in the forest for extended periods of time. And I found it to be fully acceptable within my own personal experience. And I was listening to the stories of the people that were talking about coming from more adverse situation than that, and even to the point that they live in at opportunity in a building that doesn't have running water or heat, and they're not ready to move out. They have what they need. They're comfortable. Now, that one woman that said that, she's now moved on to Eve, and maybe it's a process of returning to a larger pattern of large, you know, getting more. But Dan, my answer to your question was that's first, maybe a primary, not necessarily the first one, but on equal of addressing the dispossessed with housing, is reestablishing the norms in our culture. Because housing has moved from the 50s, where the average house was 550 square feet, to now that it's about 2,500 square feet. The square footage per person since the 60s has gone up 260%. And these are large houses, larger than we need. They're very energy and material resource intensive. And I'm very interested in how people can live comfortably and have community in these types of buildings that we're working on, equivalent to Emerald Village.
So we've lived, like I said before, part of our motivation was to live a very low impact life ourselves, and through that we had different strategies on how we accomplished that. The program for us has sort of become sort of experimental in what would it look like. Well, because we talk a lot about climate change and about needing to change societal trends and habits, well, what does that actually look like when you do it? You know, so we're faced with this sort of juxtaposition of the nuclear family lifestyle and then in our program, 15 to 20 people sharing the same amount of space as, you know, a traditional, maybe average-sized property of a city. And we try to design a program that works for that. All of the stuff that we've learned with our own experience with living a low-impact lifestyle comes into play in trying to create something for people that have nothing with very little resources. There was a time when, you know, when we first started doing community-supported shelters, you know, our income was maybe $2,000 a month. Well, what's the best way to use those resources to maximize the most amount of support for everybody involved? And so we grew and we continue to operate under those principles of being resourceful with what we have and how to extend it to people who need something. So yeah, we definitely started off with an environmental component, and that led into, well, how do we be resourceful? And now we're putting those strategies into play and seeing how they actually work on the ground.
When we started out, we were collecting things that people didn't want from the waste stream, and we were making beautiful art with them and building beautiful structures. And so now we're, you know, there's a lot of people that, because of their own blind spots or because of the economy or because of climate change, there's so many more people that aren't going to have a place to be, and we have to think differently. We have to think about how we can share more, how we can not just share physical things, but how we can share space more together, how we can be more together with people, because there's so many people that aren't going to have anything. And then there's us people that have things, and we need to learn how to share and how to be with each other more. Otherwise, I just wonder how we're going to continue as a people.
So, Faye, along that line, could you just tell people what your website address is?
www.communitysupportedshelters.org.
Thank you very much for all three of you for presenting today and doing what you do.
You weren't inspired by what you heard today, you can't be inspired. Next week, please join us on Friday, June 15th, for a presentation of the Fifth Street Market Expansion Project. Our speaker will be Casey Barrett, Vice President of OB Companies, and Brian Obie will be here to answer questions. Next week's program will be of great interest to the whole community, the expansion of Fifth Street, the expansion by the river. My challenge to every City Club member in this room, bring a friend next week. Bring a friend and turn them into a new member. You can make this a record-setting attendance. So please help generate the buzz about City Club. Now, would you please join me in thanking our speakers, John Van Landingham, Tom Bowerman, Eric and Faye DeBurr, and the wonderful introducers, Robin Quirk and Todd Schneider. This concludes today's program. See you next week. Thank you.